Well, I think we can open it to questions.
Okay.
And I know there's one question over there that was not answered last time.
Yeah.
Yes, indeed. Mm-hmm. Yeah, part of the what she was saying is part of the investigation is listening for what is not being said. Absolutely.
Somebody had asked me during a break if I would talk about how to clean up unfinished business.
You're looking at me?
So I thought that this might be a good time because the death meditation fits very well in with that, because it makes us see that we definitely have to clean up unfinished business and we can't wait for a whole long time to do it. So I think first one step is recognizing what our unfinished business is. And those are things that when we think about them, there's some discomfort. There's some feeling of being uneasy in our mind. Something doesn't feel resolved. There's something there. And to acknowledge that there's something there, that the mind isn't easy about that. Sometimes that's difficult to do because we all like to think that we've, you know, gone through the process and worked it out and reached some closure and gotten some resolution. Did I use all the right words? Got it right? Oh, I did it right. Good. And you gave me praise. That's even better. Okay. So, you know, we really like to think that we're, you know, very together people, and it's sometimes really difficult to admit to ourselves, especially when you're in the role of being a caregiver, to admit how together you are, you know, and how little you know, and how messed up your own life is. And, you know, let alone admit it to other people, it's quite frightening to admit it to ourselves. So I think this is a very important step in is getting in touch with those things where we don't feel peaceful about something. There's some tension, something going on. And looking at what those things are. And then seeing, well, what is it that's going on? Is it anger? Is it jealousy? Is it frustration or resentment? Is it clinging? Is it attachment? What is it that I don't feel comfortable with about this situation? And sometimes the answer isn't immediately apparent to us. Oftentimes we know we don't feel good about something, but we can't put our finger on it. And if we sit there and try and analyze it, we just get even more confused. You know? Especially if we tell ourselves, well, I have some emotion around this and I'm repressing it and I have to release this emotion. Where's that emotion to release? You know, I think we also have to be a little bit gentle with ourselves when we're trying to clean up unfinished business and recognize we're not going to be able to do it all at one time and things aren't going to be clear and apparent to us. And we can't force anything along this issue. But when we do see things where there's some regret or resentment or clinging, then to think, well, what are the ways to remedy that? Okay, when we have some regret, then maybe we need to sit there and think, well, why did I do that? And what were the factors operating in my mind and in the circumstance? And what is my responsibility and what wasn't my responsibility to make sure that we aren't blaming ourselves for things that we had no control over? Okay? In other words, to regret the things that are actually regrettable and not to feel guilty for the things that we had no power over. And then once we let the regret surface, then to do some purification practice. And that could come within a spiritual context, or it could come maybe within going and talking to somebody else or talking to the person who, you know, we feel we've wronged or whatever it is. But somehow cleaning it up and making some determination about the future, how we want to be in the future. And especially generating a kind heart towards the people or persons that we have harmed. Okay? So not just sitting there with the regret over, you know, misdeeds we've done and then beating ourselves up about them and feeling guilty, which we're very, very good at doing. But instead saying, okay, what happened and what was going on and how can I change this in the future? Okay, so that we make a determination about how we want to be in the future and we develop some tools in our own mind about different ways to look at a situation so that we don't keep on acting out the same old pattern again and again. Okay. So this kind of purification process, especially if you have a religious practice, can be very, very helpful for cleaning those things up. It involves a lot. It's a very humbling process, and it involves a lot of self-acceptance of our own faults and weaknesses that is a certain clarity and lucidity about them, but without the guilt. Yeah. So that's a very important thing to do. And then another one is when we look and there's a lot of clinging. You know, instead of just kind of the anger, the resentment issues, there's clinging issues. The mind is worried, it's anxious, it's fearful. Okay? And then to sit down and recognize, okay, I'm clinging to this, but is this something that it's really, does my clinging do any good? Is this something that is clingable to? And we realize that most of the things we cling to can't be clung to because their very nature is that they change and they're impermanent. So what is there to cling to? And so rather than develop the mind that says, oh, I want to fixate this in time and space, to have the attitude of, well, it's here now and it's changing and I'm changing, but I'm glad that there's time together. Yeah, so instead of going through the thing of what's it going to be like when it's gone and how can I hold on to it, it's here now, or that person's here now, and let's use this time wisely, because eventually we will separate. Okay? So that instead, you know, transform the clinging into a sense of openness and gratitude for what we have. Transform the anger and the resentment and the grudges into an attitude of forgiveness and understanding for ourselves and the other person. So these are the kinds of things I think we need to do to clean up things in our life. And like I said, it's something that we've got to start today with.
I think sometimes the identification of where your clingings are can be just as powerful as, several sessions with a good psychiatrist. That what I find very often is that I find myself in situations where I'm not connecting with my patients, or I'm not connecting with a physician, or I'm not connecting with one of my coworkers. And if I can slow down long enough to look at the content of my mind, I can usually find either judgment, doubt, or resentment in there somewhere. Those are my big three, the top 40 of mind that gets out of control. So a lot of what works with finishing business is the identification of what is it that you're holding on to. What kind of belief system are you holding on to? What are you putting between yourself and this other individual? And that individual may or may not be alive. That you can hold mind states on people who've been dead for many, many years. And you can also hold strange mindset for situations that cannot be fixed. So the investigation of what your mind is actually doing gives you a lot more room to work within the situation. Because if you're just coming from that knee-jerk resentment, you don't have a lot of play in that. You don't have a lot of room to move. But if you can say, yep, that's resentment, and is that real important right now? And what is resentment trying to protect? Because there's usually a protection component with resentment. So what are you trying to protect? Then you get some room. Then you get some movement. But it's not very easy to do. Resentment has been one that's been real interesting for me recently, and I've been watching our chaplain, who I don't know if she's actually doing this, but I'm projecting it on her because it looks pretty powerful. When I've heard her talk about someone that she's having difficulty with, she'll often stop and she'll close her eyes and say, bless her heart. Bless her heart. And what I see happen in her face is there's a transformation happening there. She's moved out of her holding into a position of being open. Whether she's actually doing that or not, I don't know. I haven't spoken to her about it. But I think it works for me when I've tried it. So those are other kinds of simpler processes that might be helpful. Just just in terms of looking at finishing business or working with sticky mind states that you're in right now.
Mm-hmm. About 6 or 7 years ago, I started getting interested in sort of new age or different sort of thought that I had grown up with. And some of the stuff you're talking about self-image and investing an awful lot in that, I think some of what I'm going through now is sort of a regeneration or a reconstruction of the self-image that I once held of who I am, what I am in the world, social conventions that I try to obey. The danger is, for me, is what I think is, so this self-image, this old self-image is gone, but now there's this even more dangerous self-image to me, it's like become spiritual materialism almost. What a good meditator I am, what a good health worker I am. It's insipid, and a lot of my friends, I think, are in the same way. Like how good we are, what wonderful people we're becoming, and it insulates me, and it's dangerous. Do you have any ideas of how one
At lunch break, it was interesting. Lee and I were telling each other how the more we each do what we're doing, the less we feel we understand and know. Yeah. And I think it's also part of learning to be comfortable that you don't have the answers, and that sometimes that self-righteousness and that pride is because we're afraid to really look at how little we know and understand.
We kind of make jokes in my house that the cats run the house and that they look at us as big, tall, and stupid. And actually, that's pretty much what they call us. Hey, big, tall, and stupid, open the tuna. But sometimes I think it's helpful for us to have someone who calls us big, tall, and stupid when we're in the midst of that spiritual pride. So maybe God is a big cat. I don't know. Pretty frightening if that's the case. But if you can bring some humor to it, I think that you can bring some lightness to it, because none of us are getting there real well. I watch my own mind when I'm in meditation and I'm doing grocery lists and I'm doing all kinds of stuff that doesn't need to be done, and then I kind of kick myself and say, what are you doing? Come on, get back here. And the humor is what usually saves me from getting too serious about what I do. And if I can laugh at myself within that, we do better. And if I don't, the cats will trip me. So you may need to find the source of your humor with where your spiritual practice is, because I think that probably is the easiest one for us to get to, rather than, like in some of the Zen traditions, they hit you with a big stick. That's not something that we can put into our regular life. We can't do that. You know, when you're driving around in your car and you're starting to get real self-righteous about, I'm a great driver, and they aren't, you're not going to have someone hit you with a big stick. But you need to come back and say, I've heard that before. I've heard that garbage before. And come back to the humor on it. Because we're pretty funny. If we listen to our mind, it's pretty funny. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Heard a question?
Okay, so this morning I mentioned about compassion and codependency. She'd like an elaboration on that. Codependency is when superficially what you're doing looks like it's kind, but your motivation is seeking something for yourself, seeking protection or security or praise or approval or whatever it is. So the action looks kind, but the motivation is one that's self-serving. Compassion and love, in a Buddhist sense, don't have that component of self looking for something for the self. In other words, the affection, the wish for others to be happy or to be free of pain, is something that's genuine, simply. And wishing those people to have happiness, for example, simply because they're other living beings exactly like us. There's no wish to protect ourselves from pain or fear of their disapproval or blah, blah, blah. It's just this being is exactly like me and wants happiness and to avoid pain. So the love and the compassion come out of that space, not from anything that's wanting something for ourselves. And so because the mind of love and compassion, the motivation is pure, then the actions that flow from that are something that is genuine kindness. Whereas the action that flows when we are looking for some benefit to ourself, to accrue, then the actions look kind, but they aren't really kind because the mind isn't, the motivation isn't there. So it's something really to look very seriously at, and not to confuse the two. And not to think that every time we're doing something kind that we're necessarily kind, but also not to think that every time we do something kind that we're being codependent and we shouldn't do anything kind. I think that's become a real danger now, that people are so afraid to be kind because they're going to be codependent. So I don't want to be codependent, so I'm going to get my needs met. Huh? And then our mind just comes like that.
Caring and being kind for people may really define who we are as humans, too. That Lauren Isley, as an anthropologist, really posed some interesting questions when he found some Neanderthal skeletons that had broken bones that were old, that the actual fibrous tissue had started to grow over itself, and that the bone had started to knit. And he said, how did this happen? Because if we think of Neanderthal people as pretty primitive, why did they care for this person so that the bone could heal? If they were hunters and gatherers, that person needed to be a productive part of that society. But that person obviously was allowed to heal, and someone fed them, so they didn't die. The difference between animals and us may be this very nature of caring then. And so it may be that we can define ourselves as that. And so when we add this codependent issue on that, as doing too much is very often what we talk about within the codependent circle, it's hard to know if there's a real natural kind of caring that's coming out of that, or is there a cause-benefit kind of thing that we're looking for. And I think within the compassion, it's where you are doing what needs to be done rather than doing what I need to get done. It's kind of the difference that I see.
And also not doing what doesn't need to be done. No?